In episode 27 of this podcast, which was called You Are Not Better, You Are Not Worse, I related a personal story about me and Leo. Leo's a small dog, a Shih Tzu, and on the surface, the story was about me picking up Leo's poop along with the poop of other dogs, dogs which had their poops abandoned on the sidewalks of our neighborhood in New York City. But really, it was a story about how I felt so superior as someone who consistently cleaned up after our dog. I was so superior to the people who didn't clean up after their dogs. I spoke about how easily my self-justified superiority morphed into self-justified righteous anger. And after a time, some inner work, I came to at least some small realization that I wasn't any better than the people I was angry at. I was still upset that they didn't clean up after their dogs. I still didn't like how they left their dogs' shit in the sidewalk for the rest of us to deal with. But I wasn't so self-righteously angry any longer. After some reflection, I saw that episode, You Are Not Better, You Are Not Worse. It only dealt with one side of the coin. I wasn't better, okay. But what about the times when I think I'm worse than someone? My impulse was to make an episode about the times when I might feel less than someone, ashamed of myself over this or that. I wanted to address my desire to climb the status ladder when I felt less than others around me. I wanted to think about how you are not better, you are not worse, might help me escape from the status ladder altogether, rather than just continuously scramble for my place on it. So near the end of the show notes for that episode, number 27, I talked briefly about how if you can let go of the whole status ladder, even for a moment, you are letting go of both superiority and inferiority at the same time. While I was writing those show notes, I had the thought, maybe this is where human dignity comes from. I was intrigued by this thought. I made a mental note to have the quote-unquote source of dignity be its own episode, and that's how the seed for this episode was planted. So when I had time to write an episode about dignity, I started with the usual, my standard internet search about dignity, just to see what was already out there. I saw some variation, but the gist of what I found was, we all need to recognize that each person has their own inherent dignity. Okay, agreed with that. And further, we need to recognize and then grant to each person their dignity in the form of rights and laws that will protect their dignity. The rights will then ensure that each of us is treated fairly and with dignity. Our inherent universal dignity was supposed to be the motivation for us to treat each other better. Immanuel Kant, who was writing in the late 1700s, used some of his incredible mind to focus on dignity. He was responding in part to the time he lived in, when dignity was granted mostly only to kings or to the wealthy or to those of a certain rank or position in society. That was changing. But at the time, they were the ones who were given dignity by others, meaning they were all treated with deference. So I saw how people got the idea that dignity is something you need to give. But Kant was saying, the truth is we all have dignity already. It is ours a priori. Dignity is there, regardless of any particular experience we have. Because dignity is inherent in human beings, regardless of the circumstances or treatment, it's not something, strictly speaking, that we can grant to each other. I found this pretty much matched my own thinking. Dignity is our own, and we cannot grant it to each other. Each of us has universal human dignity already. However, most of what I read after Kant from the 1800s on, most of what I found did treat dignity as something that each person or society had to grant to the individual or not. Everything I read intertwined dignity with human rights and with trying to treat each other well. So, for example, the United Nations came out with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. This declaration was written just after World War II, from a point of view where people really hoped that laws could be passed that would prevent tyranny. It's an incredibly optimistic document. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. For now, I'm going to read the very first section of the preamble. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. And it goes on with whereas this and whereas that. But what struck me was how the quote-unquote inherent dignity is mentioned in the same breath as equal and inalienable rights, as if those rights were inherent as well. But how others treat you doesn't seem to ever be inherent to any situation any of us are in. So while I do see dignity as inherent, I don't see rights that way. Rights and respect and fair treatment and love and kindness, none of that is inherent in human behavior as far as I can tell. Its potential may be inherent, but not the manifestation. We either cultivate treating each person with dignity and with respect, or we don't. Our social structures either support treating each other with dignity, or they don't. But for each of us, dignity is something that is inherently ours all along, no matter how we are treated. If you say to a kid, "Don't hit your little brother. He has dignity, just like you. You should treat him well because you yourself want to be treated well." I don't know how many kids will honestly understand this, evaluate it, take action on it. This is making dignity sound like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That teaching's over 5,000 years old. It can be found in the Vedic tradition in India. I guess you can say the lesson is taking a little while to sink in. What I took from all this is that inherent universal dignity got lost somewhere. It got too mixed up with needing good treatment from others. I have witnessed, personally witnessed, some people maintaining complete dignity no matter how they were treated. I've also seen others become deeply offended and feel their dignity taken away by what seemed to me to be a relatively small mistreatment. So then my mind started to think about dignity more broadly. Is a tree dignified? Is a cloud? A rock? How about a dog or a cat? What is the nature of dignity? Is it only for humans? Do all creatures have dignity? How about a molecule, a planet? What is dignity, and how does it arise? If human dignity is inherent, if it's already our nature to be dignified, why is there so little of it around? Why are people proud of behaving in a way that oppresses or harms others? Like a religion or a racial group that attacks others. If dignity is inherent to our nature, how can it be dignified to attack others? To want to harm others who have the same universal dignity as you? I can understand a dignified person being scared, but when the fear of others is so ingrained as to make someone take action to harm, well, then we're talking about Monty Python and the art of Lapgotch. The art of Lapgotch is a joke by Monty Python, and like many of their jokes, starts with a distressing aspect of human reality. Lapgotch is a secret form of self-defense. The big secret is that you attack your enemies before they think anything at all about you, before they even know you exist. It's a cute bit, but it rings way too true if you've kept up with the news during these past 1,000 years. And if human dignity is inherent, why is it so easy to offend some people? You look at someone the wrong way, you bump into someone accidentally. Watch out sometimes. People can be brutal to another for a huge range of reasons. And it doesn't look to me like it's coming from being conscious of their universal dignity. If you do read the UN Declaration, I think you'll find it mostly filled with hope. The hope of being able to grant rights to people, to make laws that can finally protect people from other people. Save us. Save us from our own worst fears and from our own worst impulses that arise out of that fear. 1948, the immediate aftermath of World War II. World War I was supposedly the war to end all wars. And after World War II, coming right after it, pretty much, it felt to me like much of humanity was kind of like an alcoholic waking up in the gutter covered in their own puke and saying, this is not good. And then immediately trying to make some rules so they won't drink anymore. I don't think you can reason your way to a reasonable way to live. I don't think just declaring our inherent dignity gives most people a sense of what it is and how to cultivate it if you don't believe you have it. If you don't see how everyone has it, if you identify as part of a group that needs to attack others to defend itself, well, perhaps if the majority of us really lived a life of universal dignity, well, maybe it could lead to something better than falling into tyranny over and over and over across the centuries. I don't know. But I think if we are going to cultivate our universal dignity, and I hope we are, then we're going to have to spend at least a little time outside of what is reasonable, outside of what makes sense. We have to get outside of what makes sense because, in addition to human life making sense when it does, all of human life also takes place outside of any sense, outside of any cognition, outside of anything we can think about. When we humans, quote unquote, make sense of things, we are creating only a tiny little island of subjective sense in a vast sea of existence that will always be, ultimately, beyond any of our reasons. So as my mind grappled with all these thoughts and it flew from here to there, I somehow came to juxtapose BDSM and universal dignity. And that's what I want to talk about today. Hello, and welcome to the 10 Crutches podcast. My name is David. I'm glad you're here. I'm going to start here with a brief explainer for anyone not familiar with BDSM. Mostly, of course, what I want to talk about is the meaning of BDSM to me and how it relates to dignity. But first, let's just establish some common language. BDSM, what does it stand for? B and D stand for bondage and discipline. Bondage is about constraining movement. For example, tying people up or strapping them to something, maybe giving them a little wiggle room to struggle or possibly immobilizing them completely. Discipline means one person strongly influencing another's behavior via reward and punishment. You know, you're usually engaged with discipline when someone is doing something they don't want to do. That's how you can tell you're making them do it or preventing them from doing something that they do want to do. B and D, bondage and discipline. Now we come to the D and S, BDSM. D and S are for dominance and submission. The last letter pair, S and M, stand for sadism and masochism. And you can see how interrelated all of these words are. If you tie up someone and spank them, that's bondage, certainly. Discipline, I suppose. There's dominance and submission in that. And then there's also giving and receiving pain, sadism and masochism. Just to finish up with the definition part, some people use these initials, BDSM, to refer to the whole kink community, even though the range of kinky play is much wider than you'll find in just strictly the activities of BDSM. Responsible BDSM will focus a lot on communication. Of course, before anything happens, you set up parameters, you set up safe words, you find out really what's wanted and what's not wanted by everyone involved. One technique, for example, to use during a scene is to have the colors red, yellow, and green of a traffic light represent a form of communication. So, for example, in the middle of a spanking, the spanker may ask the spanky what color. And then the person might say green, which means everything's okay, go ahead. Yellow might mean caution. I want you to proceed, but with caution, I'm approaching red. It's definitely not green. We have to slow down. You know, you check in about what's happening. And then, of course, red would mean stop. That could be said at any time. And also safe words are used to be able to stop the action at any time. There's also communication afterwards, mostly called aftercare. And that's about processing what happened, particularly when it makes a strong impact on one or both of the participants, or maybe all 10 of them. These kinds of behaviors happen to us all the time. Is a kid in a classroom, a kid who doesn't want to be there, is that kid being constrained? Well, it certainly felt that way to me when I was a kid in school. Is a kid trapped in a school being held in bondage? No, not exactly. You're not tied to the chair. But when the authorities of the school use reward and punishment to influence behavior to get you to keep sitting in a chair that you really don't want to be sitting in, well, that's called discipline. Even in the school, it's called discipline. And certainly in any BDSM game, same thing. The dynamic is the same. Adults who play with the B and D of BDSM, what they do is they take these very common to our life dynamics and make a game out of them. You make adult games out of them. Just like a child might play with dolls and have a doll who is the teacher, and the teacher doll yells at another doll, "You have to stay after school because you are bad." Well, adults play with these roles of good and bad. Who spanks who ties up who? Who's the top? Who's the bottom? Who's the sadist? Who's the masochist? There's games. I think of BDSM in several ways. Consider this. Pain and pleasure, to many people, seem opposite. Pain and pleasure seem totally different from each other. Pain is what you avoid. Pleasure is what you seek. Isn't that obvious? But what if it's pleasurable to you to experience some forms of pain? What do you do then? Is that wrong or bad? If someone tries to make you feel bad about the fact that you like to be spanked, if someone tries to make you feel ashamed of that, are they using words as a metaphorical whip in order to make you, quote, feel bad? If someone tries to make someone else feel bad about enjoying pain, maybe they should dress up in leather first and hold an actual whip in their hand and then start telling other people what that other person should think about pain and pleasure and all that stuff. If you enjoy pain, you should be punished, and I'm just the one to do it. And likewise, what if it brings you pleasure to cause pain in another person? What if you like to do that? If you like to cause pain and you find someone who likes to experience pain, you can make a deal. You can have a consensual relationship where one gives the pain and the other experiences the pain. Or maybe you like to constrain people or to be constrained. Most people who explore this consensually report it's really possible to feel deep intimacy with the other person during these encounters. Let's think a little more about spanking. Some people consider it kinky to either want to be spanked or to want to spank someone. But when you think about what spanking actually is, if you strip away all the meanings we give it, the approval or the disapproval, spanking is simply a form of touch. You can run your fingertips very lightly down someone's arm. That's one way of touching. You can take the palm of your hand and bring it down quickly and firmly, with varying degrees of force, onto someone's buttock and quickly lift it off. Spanking, in essence, is a form of touch. In addition to physical spanking, sometimes what's involved is also calling someone a bad boy or a bad girl. You can certainly add in that. But sometimes people have been spanked simply for their enjoyment, because they like that form of touch. Sometimes that form of touch may really wake you up to the present moment. It can potentially help you become centered and focused and, in the end, more relaxed, perhaps, than when somebody's given you a massage. When somebody's given you a good spanking, you're not paying attention to anything else. You're not worried about whatever trivial things capture your attention during most of the day. So far, I've talked about these BDSM activities in terms of being consensual. Any BDSM community will tell you how important it is to have safe words, to have a way for a particular participant to stop the action on a dime, if that's what they need. Everyone talks about and agrees to the parameters of what they will do together. But what if you like to cause pain to others, but you also like the fact that they don't consent? Well, then you have to hope that some government's going to hire you to torture prisoners, or maybe the government hires you to arrest people in some painful and violating way. You get to throw them in vans and send them off to be tortured someplace. Not wanting to get consent sometimes leads a person outside the law, like some of the really distressed serial killers that we have among us. One person can intentionally cause pain to another. That's the simple behavior. But the foundational difference is between those who don't have consent and those who do. Some just inflict the pain on you, and they get off on the fact that you don't enjoy it, you never consented, and you never would consent. That's part of what they like. They like that you don't consent. Within a BDSM community, if your thing is to not like consent, you can arrange for that. You can find someone who will consent to acting as if they don't consent. And maybe you want to be violated in some way. You want to see what that's like. You can arrange for that. You can find people who will help you have that experience in a safe way. And people really do that. It's something that happens within BDSM communities. So, for example, suppose your fantasy is to capture someone, lock them in a cage, and then rape them. That's intense. That's heavy-duty stuff. To be able to say that you want to do that and then not actually do that. Say, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to role play it out. I'm going to see what it feels like in a way that's safe for me and for everyone involved. Chances are good you're going to be able to find someone who wants to go along with that. Because someone's going to have the flip side of that fantasy. All these fantasies have two sides. They're like two sides of a coin. So you can arrange for someone to be there watching out for the safety of everyone. You can have safe words established, and everyone can know that this drama that's unfolding will be safe for everyone. And I've seen people do this. They get the consent first, they work out the details, and then they act out the scene. It's almost like writing a script for a play. But then when the play is running, you can lose yourself in it as you can act out. The fact that there are safe words means you can yell and scream at the top of your lungs. No, no, stop, stop. I don't want this. I don't like this. You can really feel how much that's true because that's the game you're playing. It's very important, I think, to be able to do these things as play, as fantasy, because when people do them for real and get off on the reality of it, it's too destructive. It's too harmful. It's too terrible. And we have to be able to make space for these things to happen so they don't have to happen in real life. Within a BDSM community, there is consent, always consent. That's foundational to these types of relationships among adults. But when you think back to your childhood, if you were stuck in a classroom, for example, and you genuinely didn't want to be there, but you knew you would be punished if you left, chances are you stayed. That's discipline in action. And we've all been disciplined in one way or another, and non-consensually, I may add. Look at many of the jokes about the henpecked husband, the emasculated husband who's ordered around by his wife. She's the dominant one, and that's supposed to be an embarrassment. For many people, the male is supposed to be the dominant one. That's but one aspect of human power dynamics. Here's some more examples. Racial bigotry. All kinds of racial dynamics flow from this bigotry. And bigotry is essentially a way of saying, I am better than you. That's a power dynamic. A billionaire says, I get to ride on a yacht, and you get to scrape by, paycheck by paycheck, if you're lucky enough to find a job. Otherwise, you might have to live on the street. That's a power dynamic. A woman concerned with how she looks. Does she have too much fat on her body? Is her makeup on properly? This concern with how she is seen, it becomes very obsessive for a lot of women. More power dynamics. We could call it a woman obsessed with how she looks, while the internalized male gaze is the master, and she must submit to what the male gaze demands. Power dynamics. Kink and BDSM are worlds where you can play games with power dynamics. Turn power into a consensual game. You play with these things because ultimately, why not? If these things create strong feelings in you, why wouldn't you play with them? If you're an enlightened guru who has seen through to the true nature of the universe, well, maybe you no longer want to play any BDSM power games, but maybe not. If anyone tries to shame anyone, that person is simply trying to discipline you. They are playing without even being aware of it, and certainly not with your consent, unless you start to feel bad, and then there you are, you're playing. If you think BDSM is primarily about sex, I will beg to differ. I say it's primarily about power. For a further discussion of power, you can listen to the 10 Crutches podcast episode number 28. It's called The Heart Chakra as Social Contract. I go through each of the chakras and discuss ways to think about them. The power chakra is the third chakra, but I recommend at least listening to the first two chakras to get into the third one so there's some context. And then, of course, listen to the fourth chakra. That's what the episode's about, the heart chakra. But honestly, I think you should listen to the whole thing. Episode number 28. One way to think about many of the problems we humans have in the world with each other. One way to think about it is because we're all trying as a species to learn about power via our third chakra. We're trying to learn about power without all of us having access really deeply to the fourth chakra, the heart chakra, so we can integrate love and power. If you really become aware of how deeply power dynamics figure in our lives, and especially how much the non-consensual use of power figures in our lives, you can see how some people might find a tremendous value in playing games with power dynamics. Power games are all around us. They are inescapable. There is no choice living with other humans but to have power dynamics. But power is not always used consensually. In fact, I would say one way to describe the worst governments, the tyrannies or the fascist states, or really any form of mafia system, if we can call them that, all are involved in a particular way to use power that is always backed up by violence. Violence is the ultimate use of non-consensual power. The power of a tyranny or of a mafia state is often used to provide for a few at the expense of the many. Mafia bosses and kings are often keen to assert dominance, to have others bend the knee or kiss the ring. This forced gesture is used to degrade others, to elevate the self over others, and ultimately to create and maintain fear. And the fear is almost always being the recipient of non-consensual violence. It looks to me like power dynamics are the ocean we humans currently swim in. So it made sense to me to consider BDSM and the people who play games with power. Whatever your relationship to BDSM, whether you're just hearing of it now or whether you've been involved in a community for years or whatever, I hope it makes some sense on why I am focusing here on that. So now that we've talked about BDSM for a little bit, let's get back to universal dignity and talk about how BDSM and universal human dignity came together for me. First, let's review a little bit. When I started exploring dignity, what I found was that it was almost always described as something that one person gave to another in the form of rights or the laws a country afforded its citizens, the way we treat each other. Dignity was something that could be given or taken away. And that wasn't really my experience with human dignity. Humans sure are capable of treating each other terribly. But when I hear about the different responses people have had to horrendous conditions, I find some people maintain their dignity no matter how they're treated. For example, being nailed to a cross was at one time a very common form of execution. Thousands of people were crucified during the Roman Empire. The Romans didn't use it on Roman citizens, but rather the lower classes and rebels. So it was considered a particularly humiliating form of punishment. But still, there's a story about one person who was being crucified actually asking forgiveness of the soldiers who were doing the nailing. That's not only maintaining dignity, but a really open heart and a tremendous compassion for all the people involved. Well, what does that mean if dignity is an inherent state and arises for some people no matter how difficult the circumstances? Why do so many descriptions of dignity talk about the need to treat each other well in order for all of us to have dignity? So as part of my research and thinking about dignity, I returned to a podcast I had heard a few years earlier. It was a podcast called Akimbo by Seth Godin. His episode about dignity is no exception to his really amazing work. I think his stuff is very good, and it's influenced me a lot. But in that particular episode, I found I disagreed with his point of view. He was asserting that dignity is something we give to each other. And one way he illustrated this was with a story about Leona Helmsley. And if you've never heard of her, she was an incredibly wealthy woman, billions of dollars. She died in 2007, and she left in her will a $12 million trust fund to take care of her dog. Apparently, it was very hard for her to be kind. She was called, I assume behind her back, the Queen of Mean. At one point, she faced tax evasion charges and was meeting in her home with her lawyer. And the following story was told by Leona Helmsley's lawyer, and that was originally told by him, but it was being repeated now in the Akimbo podcast, and I was listening to this story for the second time. And I'm listening to it after I had done my research about dignity, after I had done a lot of thinking about dignity, but before I had ever related the subject to BDSM. So here's the story. Leona Helmsley is sitting there with her lawyer discussing the tax situation, and another person in her employ, let's say it was a butler or a servant, somebody she had hired to serve her, this guy brings her a cup of tea. There's a little drop of water, apparently, on the saucer underneath the teacup, and when Leona sees this drop of water on the saucer, she takes everything. She takes the saucer and the teacup and the tea. She throws them down on the floor and they shatter. Then she orders the servant to sweep up the mess that she just made. And then, this is the topper, Leona Helmsley orders the servant to beg in front of the lawyer, beg to keep their job. But to me, the way my mind works, I'm thinking, what if they were secret lovers? What if that was just how they played? What if the whole thing was planned and consensual? I'm thinking maybe, you know, they talked about it beforehand. I'm thinking after the lawyer's gone, maybe they're both like, oh my God, did you see his face? Oh my, he was so shocked. That was so hot when I had to beg you to keep my job. Oh my God, and maybe they're hugging and kissing. You are such a bad servant. Oh yes, I'm such a bad servant. But please, Leona, whatever you do, please, don't spank me. Okay, I get it. I never knew Leona Helmsley, and I understand there's only a very, very, very small chance that any of that fantasy was true. Doesn't matter to me. To me, the only question is, was there consent? Did the butler know an unspoken part of the job description, or perhaps even spoken? Is that this distressed woman will sometimes blame you for some triviality. She's going to throw things on the floor and have you clean them up. Forget it as a part of BDSM play. Was it simply part of the job to accept verbal abuse from her? Was the butler's salary high enough so that he could just deal with it? Like, some jobs have a lot of noise. Other jobs have smells you have to adjust to. Might it be, in a way, part of the job description to offer the boss a believable performance of begging from time to time? That could be a great job for an actor. Please, please, whatever you do, don't fire me. Now, of course, given economic conditions, getting fired from a job can actually be a very serious thing. That's what I mean by consensual power dynamics. I can easily imagine a servant cowering before Leona Helmsley, genuinely intimidated by the wealth and power of this woman. I can also imagine someone who, if they need to live out of a dumpster in the streets because they can't get another job, they're still going to carry human dignity. They're going to shrug to themselves internally, and maybe they will still beg her while hating her inside or loving her inside, or someone might be able to see through her pain, see how lost and lonely she was. Maybe they would feel for her. How about someone who explodes, I will not be treated this way? I can imagine another person saying with calm and dignity, this is just too much for me, Miss Helmsley. You're going to either have to clean this up yourself or find someone else. I can no longer work for you. But you can see how my sense of inherent human dignity is that it has to arise independent of circumstance. Dignity can't rely on being treated in any particular way. I mean, I talked before about Jesus getting nailed to a cross. I mean, that's a gruesome way to die, incredibly painful, and it can take days So he's getting nailed to a cross. He's actually asking for forgiveness for the soldiers who are carrying out these orders. My imagination's good, but I cannot imagine any better example of human dignity arising within horrible circumstances. As humans, we all face treatment we have not consented to. And we also face actions we've been tricked into supporting, especially with governments. Governments often set up laws in a tricky way, but ultimately they protect people who have accumulated lots of money and lots of power. And so then, for example, a government will maybe send police to break up a strike on behalf of a factory owner. Why would a government take sides? What the hell is that about? Why wouldn't a government insist on things getting settled with fair treatment for all involved? I've come to believe that the more you cultivate your universal dignity, the more and more you see how deeply interrelated you are to all the other beings in the universe. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe the more you begin to live how deeply interrelated you are, the more you cultivate your universal human dignity. Maybe they arise together and are different facets of the same jewel. If you start to be open to treating each other human being as well as you can, treating other beings and non-human beings in ways that they consent to, if you start being one of the citizenry of all the beings on the planet, well, then you just naturally want to participate in a government that provides for all beings fairly. If universal dignity is an inherent trait we all have, the first step of cultivating it would be to pause and recognize that dignity is ours already. Dignity can emerge more fully after the things that block it are let go of. Whatever is making you feel ashamed, whatever you are compelled to hide, whatever it is in you that would treat others badly, whatever participation you have in systems, social systems that oppress others, we need to look at all the ways that make us treat others in a way that we would hate to be treated. These are the things that block our universal dignity. I'm going to ask the question again from another angle. What blocks universal human dignity? How's this for an answer? Anything that keeps us from seeing our essential, connected to everything nature. Any one person's fundamental existence is equal to all the other fundamental existences. Do you think one subatomic particle is better than another subatomic particle? Do you think water molecules argue about which is the most important water molecule? Do the cells in your liver tell themselves stories about how they are the best cells, and the cells in the pancreas, well, the cells in the pancreas thing can just go fuck themselves? I mean, it's funny to consider it, but now that life is complex enough to include humans, how come all of a sudden it's so easy for me to think I am better or worse than someone else? Different abilities, to be sure, different cultures, to be sure, different ways of looking at the world, different values, different skin colors, different beliefs, lots of differences. But one human better than another, not possible. More and more universal dignity will emerge or can be experienced as more and more compassion for all beings arises, especially having some compassion for the people who spend so much of their time hating. Hating. Hating's hard on a human life. It's lonely. The only other people you get to bond with are people who like your particular flavor of hating. Or maybe people who need your economic support will at least pretend to like you or like to be with you. I think one of the problems with being a human is that we only get to live 80 to 100 years at the most. And lots of folks, that's just not long enough to see how empty all the hating is, to see how isolating it is. It's not long enough to just get thoroughly sick of it. So now you have a sense of how I connected BDSM and dignity. Maybe I should end here, but I want to go on with one more riff. I want to go on before I bring this all in for a landing. I want to circle back around to the value I see in BDSM, particularly the ability to play with and act out power games, to not take them quite so seriously, and to find ways to make power consensual. The use of power needs to become consensual. As I said, the freedom to play with this power, it makes something very clear. There is a clear distinction between those who play with consent and those who play without. No one can escape playing with power. No one escapes power, and no one escapes powerlessness. Consent or no consent, those are the important variations. Okay, so here we go. Here's my riff. The 10 Crutches podcast episode number 14 was called Five Things That Make It Hard to Be a Human. One of the things I thought made it hard to be a human is that we stand between huge and tiny without ever landing definitively in either size. We humans are not a definite size. We are huge compared to, for example, a molecule of insulin. We are the size of the earth compared to a molecule of insulin. And at the very same time, living as we do on the surface of the earth, we are the size of a molecule of insulin hanging out on the surface of the earth. That's our size relative to the whole planet Earth. We're not only large and small physically in space, we're also large and small in time. Compared to the little flashes and flickers that happen at the quantum level, flashes that last for a nano or a picosecond, we live for ages and ages compared to those little flashes. But if you live for 100 years, that's only about 20 seconds compared to the 4 billion years that the Earth has lived so far. Most of us are conscious of the tiny size and the tiny amount of time we have, but you could just as easily flip it. The thing is, it's just not clear. What's our definite size? What's our definite length of life? So in episode 14, I talked about how difficult I think it is for humans to be so indeterminate. I think it really bugs most people most of the time, without ever being aware of it. It's just too much stress to manage, too much uncertainty to handle. And so people end up believing with 100% certainty all kinds of improbable beliefs, improbable, sometimes religious beliefs, or maybe improbably they believe in the infallibility of science or the infallibility of the Pope or maybe their own infallibility, like I do sometimes. But not only are we both huge and tiny in space and time, that's not all. There's another thing I think makes it very, very hard to be human. And I didn't mention this particular way in episode 14. I stopped at 5 because, well, that seemed like enough for one episode. So my riff is going to veer into another weird duality that we humans have to live with, never before mentioned on the 10 Crutches podcast. So here it is. We humans are completely, completely at the mercy of all the causes and conditions that surround us. That's on one side of the duality I'm talking about. It's kind of like being on one side of a coin. Every cause and condition affects us. It moves us from here to there, sometimes like a pool ball getting hit across the table. We are being swept up in, swept along with the current of life. We are completely in it, and we can't control any of it any more than chemicals can control what happens to them when they get poured into each other in a lab, or what happens to water when it flows over a waterfall. We can't control any of it. And this side of the coin, I think, is what gives rise to ideas of fate, to thinking that there's no such thing as free will. The causes and conditions we are born into, they've been happening for millions, nay, billions of years before we were born. And then we get born into whatever situation. We emerge out of this situation, and then all those causes and conditions now include us. Once we're born, the universe now includes all of our actions and reactions, all of our wantings and not wantings. Everything adjusts accordingly in the tiny slash huge local spot we're living in. And the little pebble of our actions sends a ripple out into the pond of the universe, however subtle it may be. If you really like your life, I think that means really you've summed up somehow, subjectively summed up the experience you're having of these universal causes and conditions, and you like them. You like what the universal causes and conditions have resulted in. Or you may hate your life, and that means essentially the same thing. You've looked around, you've assessed it, you evaluate it, and you come up with a negative emotion. Any person who likes their life is more likely to think that they've created their life, that their choices have resulted somehow in the way that they live. They think their choices are causal. Someone who hates their life probably tends to think that other people's choices and other people's actions are what's causal for them. I think on this side of the coin, the side of the coin where there's only causes and conditions, I think everybody's kidding themselves about choice. On this side of the coin, there's no choice. There's just the causes and conditions arising and us bumping into each other and doing whatever the hell it is we do. On this side of the coin, there is no choice. There's only acting it out, the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly. Even the richest, the most powerful among us, or the poorest among us, we're all just little molecules telling ourselves a story about how hard we worked or how unlucky we are in the vast emptiness of the universe. The other side of the coin, the other polarity to being at the individual mercy of causes and conditions, is to see that the whole universe is manifesting itself through all of us, in all of us, as all of us. The whole universe is the power of creation. It's the mastery. It's all of our ability to create and destroy and manifest. That's on the other side of the coin. We all have a choice. We all can live within our causes and conditions because we live as an intelligent universe. We live out our intimate connection to all the rest of it. We are all powerful beyond what we can know, beyond what we can do, beyond what we can think about, beyond our little stories. We are also, all of us, completely helpless and vulnerable. We are each the coin. And one side is the master of the universe, and at the very same time, on the other side of the coin, we are each little bits of life at the mercy of causes and conditions, both at the same time. So forget the confusion of not knowing what size you are. Can you imagine how easy it is to be confused by being both the universal master and also the helpless individual universal servant at the same time? What kind of a coin is that to manifest? Part of the reason people want to be powerful, or why they want to accumulate money, is that when they get a little taste of what it's like to believe that you were the cause, you got to order cause and effect, at least in your own little sphere, these stories about my power, people can feel like they're imposing their will on what's around them. And that's intoxicating. That makes you feel like you've solved the problem, like you landed on the side of the coin that of the whole universal intelligence, but you landed as an individual. You can forget the other side. You can forget the other side, but it's still there. The side of the coin that has the power is universal. It's not yours personally. It's not your personal power. Personally, individually, all you have are causes and conditions. This belief in a mistaken story can give you a sense of why someone wants to keep going and going and going with being rich and powerful, not ever wanting to stop, because that would mean they might have to deal with realizing they are forever simply subject to causes and conditions, just like the rest of us. All of us, rich and poor, are completely equal in our manifestation of the one universal reality, as well as being completely equal and subject to causes and conditions. We are the cause. We are the effect. We are the whole universe moving everything around and at the same time. Individual, separate, we are being moved. We are both mover and moved.
At the same time.
Simultaneously being the mover and the moved is not resolvable. Just like we can never definitively say what size we are, we can never definitely abide only in the mover or the moved. So if you take a creature, for example, you take a creature like a human living in this predicament, living in this impossibility, and then you say, oh, I got an idea. Let's run a lot of sexual energy through this confused human. So now, on top of the whole predicament, oh, now you can start sprinkling in all kinds of things. You have your particular cultural trainings. You have your religious trainings. You can add in economic conditions, favorable or unfavorable. You get a family. You get a town you get raised in. You get whatever weird things your nation is up to at the moment, all the ways it benefits and harms people, all the particular circumstances of a life. You sprinkle in all these individualities and sexual energy, and you can imagine that this confused human, one of them, might be drawn to the master side, to being in charge, to having control, and another's going to be more drawn, perhaps, to being submissive, to giving up control, to prefer to being told what to do. Some people might play with one end and then the other, and switch back and forth between the two polarities of mover and moved. I hope you can see in this picture, you are always, all the time, both the mover and the moved. You're always in charge, and you're always not in charge at all. At the same time, you're both able to completely determine your experience, and at the same time, you have nothing at all to do with determining your experience. I believe these impossible polarities make us very vulnerable to finding all kinds of things sexually exciting. We're like little ducks who follow a balloon of sexual turn-on around and bond with it like it's our little mother duck. We all have things that sexually excite us, and in addition to sex, we have our combination of using and avoiding our power that's either going to help us and help the world or harm ourselves and harm the world. Okay, so what? We're both really huge and really small. Is that a big deal? Even our sun. Think of the sun, this enormous star. Compared to us, it's enormous, just a few light minutes away. It's both huge and really small. Our sun is tiny, in a way, compared to the galaxy that it's in. We live as a flash in time, and we live in eternity. We manifest from, we emanate from, let's call it the prime mover, the first mover, of the entire universe, and we're also completely subject to its causes and conditions. In order to learn about sex and power and love in order to learn about human dignity, there is no other place to start but from where we already are, right in the middle of the mix. You find yourself in the midst of your life, and you take it from there, over and over, listening to this podcast after it's over, having breakfast. You might just all of a sudden remember, oh yeah, universal dignity, universal love. Over and over, we come back to the present because over and over, we leave the present in our minds to whatever particular fantasy we're acting out. To me, it makes total sense that some people use games to explore, with consent, many different aspects of sex and power, aspects that other people seem compelled to impose without any consent at all. When you explore sex and power without consent, when you have, for example, masked thugs or federal officers, whatever you want to call them, any kind of Gestapo, when you have people arresting people without due process, sending them off perhaps to be tortured, perhaps murdering them, and then lying about what you're doing, of course that behavior is done without consent. I think it's important to recognize these are power dynamics explored in any BDSM gathering. It's the same game, just done without consent. The point is, if you find yourself in a moment without dignity, you can think again. You can remember that your intimate intertwining is with all of creation. All of creation has already bestowed you with the dignity of the sun and the moon and the swirling galaxies and the clouds and the rocks and the plants and the animals. You are on completely equal ground with all humans everywhere, no matter how anyone is treating anyone. Each and every human is dignified, universally dignified throughout space and time. Universal human dignity is always present in everything we do. But it sure can feel at moments like our dignity is gone. You can observe your circumstances and realize that there's nothing that needs to change in the circumstances for you to have dignity. At the same time, you can also realize you're not being treated well. You're not being treated with your consent. Or perhaps you're not treating someone else with their consent. You can wake up and start to do better. Leona Helmsley smashing her teacup, ordering you to pick it up. Nothing to do with your dignity. She's playing a game of my money makes me better than you. And you can play along with her. You can walk away. You can be kind to her, you can be mean to her, it's your call. Nevertheless, if you ever lose your dignity, it just simply means you don't know where it is. You only have to remember that your little slice of the universe is a fountain of universal dignity. There's no end to your universal dignity because there's no end to the universe. I'm hoping that the more we can experience the genuine equality of each of our dignity with all the dignity of all the rest of the universe, the easier it's going to be for us to exercise power. Exercise our power with the consent of all beings. I am hoping that it becomes more and more likely not only to seek out consent, but also to demand consent for ourselves and how we all are treated. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time. Please visit the home of the 10 Crutches podcast at 10crutches.link. That's 10crutches.link. The book that inspired the podcast, a book I wrote called 10 Crutches for Walking in the Present, is available for free download on the website. While you are there, please take advantage of two ways to contact me. You can send me an email, or you can make a voice recording. If you have a great question, I may be able to use it for the podcast. Also on the website, you can visit the archive to hear any published episode and see show notes for any and every show. Thanks so much for listening. And once again, thanks so much for listening. And I won't say it once again. See you next time.